Welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federal Society's Labor and Employment Law Practice Group, was recorded on Friday, July 28, 2017, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federal Society members.
Welcome to the Federalist Society's telephone conference call. This afternoon, we will discuss the latest updates in the DOL overtime rule. My name is Laura Flint. I'm the Deputy Director of Practice Groups here at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Today we are happy to have with us Tammy D. McCutcheon, who is a shareholder at Littler Mendelson and also the chair of our Labor and Employment Law Practice Group here at the Federalist Society. I will turn it over to Tammy to get us started. After opening remarks, we'll go to audience question and answer. Thank you for speaking with us, Tammy. The floor is yours.
Thank you, Laura. I asked lawyer Laura to quickly organize this teleforum because we do have some developments on the overtime regulatory issues that I wanted to share with you and on the litigation. Those that know me may know that I served as the wage and hour administrator in the Bush administration and was in that position in 2004, the last time these overtime regulations were changed. I also wrote comments on the Obama administration regulations on behalf of the Chamber of Commerce and represent the chamber in the litigation challenging that 2016 final rule. And of course, I am speaking here today on behalf of myself, not my law firm, not my clients, just on behalf of my own and my views based on my experience with these regulations. So I'm sure that many of you in our audience today have been following the attempt by the Obama administration to revise the Fair Labor Standards Act regulations that define when an employee may be classified as exempt from the overtime requirement as a white-collar employee, that is, as an executive, administrative, or professional employee. Before I start talking a little bit about the recent developments in the regulation and in the litigation, I did want to give some brief background for those of you in our listening audience who are not as much of wage and hour geeks as I am. So this all started in May 2016 when the Obama administration issued a final rule to revise the regulations at 29 CFR Part 541, which defined who is an exempt white-collar employee. Now, since 1940, okay, that's a lot of background. I'm not going to do it year by year, I promise. These rules have contained three tests for exemption. The salary basis test, which says that an employee must be paid a salary that is guaranteed and can't be reduced because of the quality or quantity of work performed. The salary level, which is a minimum amount of salary that an employee must be paid to be exempt. And then the duties test. There's a set of duties under for executive, administrative, and professional that the employee must perform in order to be exempt. Now, before the 2016 rule, the last update to the salary level and the duties test was during the Bush administration in 2004 under my leadership. Before that, the last update had been, and it was a salary-only update, had been in 1975. And we're really going to be focusing on the salary level requirement today. In 1975, until we changed it in 2004, the minimum salary for exemption was set at $155 per week under what was then called the long duties tests, but employees who earned $250 a week could be exempt under the short duties tests. Now, because there had been such a long time that passed between 1975 and 2004, that $155 minimum salary level was actually below minimum wage, and $250 was not much above it. So there was a real need to update the salary levels. After all, it had been 30 years. And because it had been so long, that long duties test, the more vigorous requirements that went along with the $155 minimum salary, because it was below minimum wage starting like in the 1980s, that had basically not been used for decades. It was a non-functioning test because most people earned well above even the $250 that applied with the shorter, less vigorous duties tests. So in 2004, what we did is we eliminated this whole complex structure of long test, short test, instead adopting a single set of duties tests and a single salary level of $455 per week. That was $23,660 per year. Needless to say, you won't be surprised to hear that there was a lot of resistance to our rule. Unions, employee advocates, Democrats criticized our salary level as way too low, claiming that we had inappropriately matched the equivalent of the old long test salary level with a short test duties test, which I disagree with because our standard test was a mixture from the long test and short test. One of the key things we eliminated from the test that was part of the long test before 2004 was a restriction on employees performing more than 20% of their time performing non-exempt work. Those of you who might have retail clients understand it's really, really hard to determine whether or not your employees are spending, and this is for tip credit. If you're a tip credit employee, you can't spend more than 20% of your time performing non-tipped duties, according to DOL. It's almost an impossible standard to track and meet, so it's not really a workable test. Anyway, everybody who was an employee advocate hated our regulation. They thought it was too easy for people to be exempt. So in the second term of the Obama administration, DOL set out to correct my mistake and increase the minimum salary level for exemption from $455 per week to $913 per week. So what that meant was employers were required to pay overtime to every employee who earned less than $47,476 annually, regardless of their job duties. So if there was a young attorney not working in big law who was earning $47,000 a year, that attorney would be eligible for overtime pay. So that new rule was scheduled to go into effect on December 1st, 2016. There was a lot of objections, of course, in the business community that 913 was way too high, especially in the retail restaurant sector in nonprofits, usually a solid supporters of employee protections. This time the nonprofits came out against the rule and basically said, we're going to have to fire a lot of people. We can't afford either the overtime or the increased salary level. Also, the healthcare industry was going to be severely impacted by this. So before it went into effect, 21 states' attorney generals, led by Nevada, and a bunch of business associations who Littler, my firm, Maury Baskin, and I represent, filed lawsuits to stop the new rule in the Eastern District of Texas. And you gotta love the Eastern District of Texas. Just days before that December 1st effective date, on November 22nd, 2016, Judge Mazant from the Eastern District of Texas did issue a preliminary injunction stopping the rule. He found that the Obama rule was inconsistent with Congress's intent for the exemption to apply to employees who perform executive, administrative, and professional work. The key quote from Judge Mazant's opinion, and this is all going to play into the DOL's reply brief, so just be patient with me. The key quote, I think, from Judge Mazant's opinion is that the rule was directly in conflict with Congress's intent. The FONA rule states, and this is a quote from the FONA rule, white-collar employees subject to the salary level test earning less than $913 per week will not qualify for the exemption and therefore will be eligible for overtime irrespective of their job duties and responsibilities. And that's really what rubbed Judge Mazant wrong, is the DOL saying it doesn't matter what your job duties and responsibilities are. If you make below $47,476 annually, you cannot be exempt. While the statute, the exemption in the statute applies not based on salary level, but based on that you're performing executive, administrative, or professional duties. So what he really held then was that Congress intended to exempt these white-collar employees based on job duties, but the Obama DOL had set the minimum salary level so high that millions of employees who perform those job duties would be excluded from the exemption. Now, as you might imagine, the Obama administration quickly appealed Judge Mazant's ruling to the Fifth Circuit and asked for expedited review. The Fifth Circuit granted that motion and set a briefing schedule with DOL's final brief being due on February 2nd, 2017. Well, then came inauguration. And the incoming Trump administration, instead of pushing for expedited review, started requesting extensions of times to file their reply brief in the Fifth Circuit, first to March 2nd, then to May 1st, and finally to June 30th, which is when they did file their reply brief. So that brings us up to date sort of with the history of what's been happening. So let's talk about these two recent developments. First, DOL's reply brief and then the status of the litigation. It is a strange reply brief. If you've read it, I hope you agree with me. Because in my mind, what it does is it challenges a finding, a ruling that Judge Mazant never actually made and doesn't question the ruling he did make. Let me explain. I guess the best place to start is with the brief's conclusion, which I'm just going to quote for you. For the foregoing reasons, the department requests that the court reverse the judgment of the district court because it was premised on an erroneous legal conclusion and reaffirm the department's statutory authority to establish a salary level test. The department requests that this court not address the validity of the specific salary level set by the 2016 final rule, which the department intends to revisit through new rulemaking. So, two parts of this. First, DOL announces its intention here to go to revisit the salary level through new rulemaking, and so ask the Fifth Circuit not to rule on the validity of the specific 913. But the first part of this, what DOL says is that the district court's decision needs to be reversed because it was based on an erroneous legal conclusion that DOL does not have any authority to establish any salary level test. Page 4 of DOL's reply brief, in fact, states the district court reasoned that a salary test is unlawful. Now, this puzzles me because of footnote 2 in Judge Mazant's opinion, which states, and I quote, the court is not making a general statement of the lawfulness of the salary level test. Now, I know there's a general belief out there that Judge Mazant found that DOL could not have any salary level test because there's no salary mentioned in the statute itself. But folks, I was there at the preliminary injunction hearing. In fact, I got a ticket because it went so long. The parking outside the courthouse was limited to 3 hours, and the preliminary injunction hearing went about 3.5 hours. What I can say is read the footnotes, please. Isn't that what they told us in law school? Read the footnotes. Judge Mazant stated that he was not making a general statement of the lawfulness of the salary level test. But DOL's only grounds for reversal of Judge Mazant's opinion is that he, quote, reasoned that a salary test is unlawful. Mazant did not reason that a salary level test was unlawful. He invalidated the regulation because the Obama salary level was so high that it excluded millions of employees who were performing executive, administrative, and professional duties. That's all. So here's the question I have. You know, has DOL waived all of their arguments on appeal, right? The only thing the only thing Judge Mazant ruled was that 913 was too high, and DOL asked the Fifth Circuit not to opine on whether 913 was too high. Love to hear people's opinions of my theory on this. So then the other question is, what does DOL exactly want the Fifth Circuit to do? Do they really want the Fifth Circuit to reverse and get rid of the preliminary injunction? Well, I certainly hope that doesn't happen because There's some precedent out there now that I'm going to talk about, that if the Fifth Circuit reverses, lifts the preliminary injunction before DOL has finalized a replacement rule, hopefully a more modest, reasonable salary level, that that this regulation is in effect, right? It went into effect December 1st. But if you get rid of the preliminary injunction, it is a rule that's in effect. And without an exemption, there is now a precedent that if the Fifth Circuit reverses, the preliminary injunction goes away, that not only will that 913 rule go into effect, but it could be applied retroactively back to its original effective date of December 1st. Yep, you heard me correctly. From December 1st. And a court could hold that an employer would be liable for overtime pay for any exempt employee not earning at least $9.13 per week. And if you don't believe me, let me refer you to three district court cases involving the home care industry. Beltran versus Inter Exchange Inc. out of the District of Colorado, Jasper versus Home Health Connection, and Weingard versus Self-Reliance Inc., both out of the Southern District of Ohio. Now, these cases involved a final regulation by the Obama administration in 2013, which took away the overtime exemption for home care workers. As with this white-collar exemption, Littler represented the home care industry in litigation to invalidate that rule. We actually won a permanent injunction in the D.C. District Court. Thank you, Judge Leon. I love you. But the D.C. Circuit reversed. And in these three cases that I just mentioned, the district courts applied the home care rule retroactively, requiring the employers to pay overtime back wages to employees during the period and for the period in which the home care rule had been enjoined, rejecting arguments that they didn't have to pay overtime during the period because it was because the District Court of D.C. had enjoined it. So, what is the worst case here for employers, for your clients? I think it's that the Fifth Circuit does what DOL has asked them to do and reverses Judge Mazant's, vacating the preliminary injunction before the department has finalized a replacement rule. And then you're going to start getting a lot of complaints alleging. And some courts, you know, if you're in Southern District, Ohio, you know, boy, you've got a problem, or the district, or in Colorado, that courts could start following those district court cases and applying that 913 minimum salary level retroactively all the way back to December 1st, even during the time period, even though the rule was enjoined by the Eastern District of Texas. That, I believe, would be disaster for our clients, disaster for our economy. Okay, let's get to DOL's request for information that was published in the Federal Register on Wednesday. DOL has asked for comments on the Obama 2016 final rule. They list 11 specific areas that they're requesting comments on. I'm just going to go through them really, really briefly, and then I want to wind up my comments talking about the interplay between the regulations and the regulatory process. So let me take a drink of water here real quick. It's a long list. What methodology should DOL use in setting the salary level test? They're contemplating just increasing the 2004 salary level by inflation using the 2004 methodology, but they've requested comments on any, you know, how should the salary level be set? Should the regulations contain multiple standard salary levels by size of employer, region, state? In other words, should you not have one salary level but dozens? Personally, I don't think that's a really good idea. You know, law is complex enough as it is without having to figure out for a national employer whether the employee is exempt, and employees who make $40,000 are exempt in Mississippi but not in California. Should the department set a lower salary for executive and administrative employees and a higher salary for professional employees? That is another complexity that we got rid of in 2004. Having different salary levels for the different exemptions, that was in place. That was put in place in 1963 through 2004 when we tried to simplify the regulations. Fourth, should the salary level test be set based on the old long test, the short test, or somewhere in the middle? This one goes back to the Obama administration's argument belief that the 2004 salary level was set too low because it was the long test salary level attached to a short test duties test. I think this will be really hard to respond to for us attorneys and business associations. And that is, how did the employers respond to the 2016 final rule and the preliminary injunction? Who implemented, who didn't, who backed away after the preliminary injunction was issued, and what was the impact on their workplaces, both economically and non-economically? That information, I think, will be hard to get because it's really a employer-by-employer type of information, but maybe some of the trade associations in responding to the RFI will do some surveys. Does the 913 salary level eclipse the role of the duties tests in determining the exemption status? This one I like. Should the salary test be eliminated entirely? Eight, does the 913 salary level exclude traditionally exempt occupations? I think we're talking about like assistant managers in particular. If so, which occupations, and do those occupations perform more than 20% or 40% non-exempt work per week? That sort of scares me a bit because that's a reference to that old long test where it had that 20 and 40% restriction against non-exempt work in order to meet the exemption on the long test. And I certainly hope they're not really contemplating bringing back the long test. Nine, are the provisions of the 2016 final rule allowing the use of non-discretionary bonuses and commissions to meet up to 10% of the salary level appropriate? In other words, should they keep that 10% commission and bonus rule that was in the 2006 final rule? They have the same question for the compensation level for the highly compensated test, whether they should have different levels for different regions or states or size of employer. And finally, the 11th thing they've asked to comment on is should they adopt the Obama administration's plan to have automatic increases, every 3 years. So that's a lot of questions. We're just starting to work through them. I am going to be writing comments for the chamber, so I don't want to get any more in depth into my views on each of these. Some of them, I will say, opened the doors to some changes that I would never endorse myself. Don't know what my client is going to tell me. I don't want to go back to a short and long test. I really don't like having different salary levels based on geography or industry or whatever. The purpose of, like minimum wage, the purpose of the federal law is to set a minimum floor level that works everywhere in the country, right? We don't have different minimum wages based on, the state or the size of the employer. And if states want a higher salary level, just like minimum wage, they can adopt one. So they have given us you can find the full request for information at federalregister.gov. Just look for the Wednesday, July 26th issue. Comments are due in 60 days. That's September 25th and can be easily posted or uploaded directly into regulations.gov. So you can just write your comments into a box or you can upload a letter. To do that, you need to go to regulations.gov and search for RIN number 1235. -AA20. So you just put that in the search box and you'll come up with it. What I'd like to comment more on today, I guess, is why a request for information. An RFI does not actually begin a regulatory process and doesn't automatically actually lead to the first step in the regulatory process, which is a notice of proposed rulemaking or NPRM. It's just what it says. It's a request for information from the agency to the public on a topic that the agency is considering regulating on. So in my opinion, it just delays regulation. It's an extra step, which is not required under the Administrative Procedures Act. So here, the RFI means that DOL cannot now start the regulatory process by issuing an NPRM until after the comment period closes on September 25th, and they've had time to review the comments that come in. That could take a month, 2 months, 3 months. So really the earliest that the DOL could issue a notice of proposed rulemaking would be October, like the end of October. If they take less than a month after the comment period closes on the RFI, they will be accused of not considering the comments that they requested, and that was all, you know, a shamara. For the 2016 rule, I will also remind you all, DOL received 293,394 comments. So my other question is, doesn't DOL have everything they need to know about what the regulated community thought about that 47476? Now, we were commenting, those 293 comments were on the proposed rule, which had a salary level of like 50,000, and DOL only reduced it by 3,000. So I think, you know, I don't think anybody who commented and said that 50,000 was way too high would have been like, okay, all right, 47, no problem. So I think they should already have everything they need to know from both sides based on those comments to issue an NPRM. And finally, let's go back to the litigation, and then we can open it up for questions and comments. DOL has not moved to stay the Fifth Circuit appeal while they regulate. As I mentioned, they've asked the Fifth Circuit to reverse. Although the Fifth Circuit has not yet set oral arguments, and of course we don't know who the panel is, historical data about the timing of Fifth Circuit appeals shows that they could rule end of this year, beginning of next year, January. Since DOL cannot now issue a proposed rule until October at the earliest, it seems very unlikely that a final rule will issue before the Fifth Circuit decision issues. And that will raise all those issues about retroactivity and the rule going, and even if it is not applied retroactively, if there is no new DOL rule and the Fifth Circuit lifts the injunction, that 913 is going to go into effect going forward. Usually it takes about a month between decision and the appellate court issuing a mandate. So you and your clients could have like less than a month's notice, right, that the preliminary injunction is gone and the Obama 2016 final rule at 913 per week is in effect. So I guess that leaves me with two questions for DOL. Why not a motion to stay in the Fifth Circuit while you regulate? I mean, what's the downside? And why the RFI rather than going straight to a notice of proposed rulemaking? And that's my sort of commentary on what's going on in overtime. Laura, if you want to go ahead and open the lines for questions and comments.
Let's go to audience questions. In a moment, you will hear a prompt indicating that the floor mode has been turned on. After that, to request the floor, enter star, then the pound key. When we get to your request, you will hear a prompt, and then you may ask your question. We will answer questions in the order in which they are received. Again, to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound key on your telephone keypad. Let's go to our first question.
Good morning, Ms. McCutcheon. This is Roman Druk from Feinbach & Perkins out in California.
Hi.
Given that the DOL has decided basically not to contest much of the substance of Judge Mazant's ruling, what do you think is the likelihood of the Fifth, I mean, obviously it's impossible to predict, but of the Fifth Circuit actually overturning the injunction? Because in California, that was a concern. We basically told, you know, our clients not to worry about it given the election results, and now I'm concerned that may be
I will tell you, now we've had an internal discussion here at Littler about, you know, what should we, based on the home care cases and what DOL is doing, do we need to go out there and alarm our clients at this point? And we decided not to, right? I think we're still time to wait and see, to see what the timing is going to be. Like, watch closely for when the Fifth Circuit puts us on the calendar for oral argument, and then who's on the panel. You know, we didn't pick Texas by accident when we went to litigation, and the Fifth Circuit is is the best circuit we can be in. All of you who are longtime Federalists and have heard Edith Jones speak, if we get Judge Jones, I'm like, you know, and one more Republican, then your clients won't have to be concerned. But I think if we do get a bad panel and it looks to be moving quickly, and we hear nothing more from DOL, then I think it might be time to talk to our clients a little more about the possibility that the 913 could go into effect if DOL doesn't act. I hope DOL is watching too, and they don't let that that 913 go into effect.
Thank you. Appreciate your input.
We have another caller in the queue.
Hi, Tammy. It's Pepper Crutcher down in Jackson, Mississippi. I have a question premised on what happened about 1:39 a.m. Eastern Time this morning on the Senate floor. We've got an executive order that says to administrative agencies, hey, would you please go easy on folks regarding the Affordable Care Act to the extent the law allows you to do so. Do you think, given what you know about the comments to the 2016 rule and DOL reactions to those comments, that it might be useful to cite that executive order to say, why can't you allow group health plan contributions by employer to count toward the salary level?
Well, I think there's another opportunity to do it, and I think it's well worth the time because there's some other things that they've asked for comments on that would be increased burdens significantly on employers, which is, you know, contrary to the early regulatory EO, that Executive Order 13777 that says we're supposed to avoid and repeal regulations that eliminate jobs or inhibit job creation, and I think both overtime and ACA do that. I'm sure you think that too, Pepper. So I think it's very worth filing. And I know what an expert you are in ACA, so I would encourage you to go online and even – you don't even have to write a letter, Pepper. You just have to – you know, there's a text box, and you go in there and put some stuff on. I think that would be very valuable, and I will certainly consider it in the comments I'm writing. And if you want to send me anything, I'd be happy to look at them and see if we can get it included. Great.
Let's go to our next question.
Hi, Tammy. Betsy Dormany in Georgia. It's Old Homes Week, as usual. I have a comment and a question. The comment is really about one large employer in my town who is not a client, I hasten to add, but who decided that it would implement the Obama administration new rules and consequently has chopped a whole lot of people down to hourly who had formerly been salary and who had been carrying out a lot of very administrative-y type tasks like grant writing, for example, and that is a large university. So that might be a place where you could find some experience.
Right.
It's generally been pretty negative for the people that I know who have been affected by this rule because they've basically been told that their 60-hour jobs have to be done in 40, and they get in a whale of a lot of trouble if they do any overtime, because the university has really taken it on as a cost-saving measure more than anything else. So that's my comment. My question is if you could have any more thoughts about the ratchet effect or the ratchet provision that was in this legislation, because I bumped up against that the other day looking at some OSHA penalty regs where they said that it was an FLSA penalty regs where they were saying, you know, well, we'll revisit this automatically as, you know, consumer price index or whatever it is goes up. And I seem to recall you talking about some challenge to that sort of automatic ratchet up effect in legislation. I wondered if you'd care to comment any further about that?
Yeah, you know, there were a number of bills that were pending between either right before or after the final rule came out. Of course, they haven't been reintroduced yet because there's felt been no need, because I think there's an expectation in Congress that DOL is going to take care of this. But they do request comments on the automatic ratcheting increases, the business community was against that because when you have the automatic, it's automatic increases, right? When the economy slows down, it never goes down. It's always ratcheting up. And, of course, the other objection we had in our comments to the Obama-era rules was that the methodology for the ratcheting it up would make that what they were going to do is every year take a snapshot to see what the 40th percentile of salary levels are. And the problem is with that methodology is if the data set only includes exempt employees. So as as employees who earn below 47,476 are moved out because they're reclassified, the whole salary level structure in the entire country goes up. So every time you take that picture, it's higher and higher and higher. And there were some economists who, during the first set of NPRM who were ignored, showed that it would ratchet up to over 100,000 very, very quickly, like within 5 years. So I think everybody has to comment that that's a really bad idea. And I tell you, talking with folks around here, the question is, are they opening the door? Are they really considering keeping the automatic increases? Or do they just need information from employers about why it's a really bad idea again? Now, they could just read my comments that I wrote for the chamber last time to see why that's all a bad idea. But we'll say it again of why it's a bad idea. But I think I have not heard of any activity in Congress to correct this through legislation because they'd rather have DOL do it, and they think DOL is taking care of it. As you heard today, I'm not so sure that DOL is taking care of it in the right way. And I will tell you, Secretary Acosta is one of us guys. He's been a Federal Society member and an active member since I've known him 15 years. I think he's a great and wonderful guy. I'm just not sure he's getting the right advice about how to approach all this.
Quick follow-up, if I may.
Sure.
But thank you very much for that, and I couldn't agree with you more. Have they considered a minimum wage multiple as a federal minimum wage multiple, I might add, not to get into what the states decide to do on their own, but have they considered that as an alternative to the ratchet?
Well, I will tell you, that's one of the reasons I don't think ratchets or the automatic increase for the minimum salary level is actually legitimate. I think Congress and the FLSA has never done what the states do and apply an automatic increase based on inflation or anything. That has never been done, in the 69-year history of the FLSA. There has never been automatic increases in any of the salary levels, not the tip credit, not the minimum wage, not the sub-minimum wage for teenagers, none of it. And so I don't think it's appropriate for DOL to have. And in fact, in 2004, we were asked to put in automatic increases, and our preamble said that we did not have authority to do so. Now, of course, in 2016, they said, well, yeah, Tammy was wrong. They said that a lot in 2016 in the preamble. You know, it doesn't say Tammy. It says they were in 2004, we were wrong. In 2004, we were wrong about 200 times. But one thing, too, before I let you go, I will say on your story about the university, those are the stories that DOL really needs in responding to this. So if you have clients and you can collect those stories from your clients, one, encourage your clients to file comments talking about how it impacted it, talking about how it hurt or helped, whatever, the employees, what they did, how much it cost them, what happened to the employees. Those stories are what DOL is looking for. And frankly, unless they have a good amount of number of stories showing that this change was hurtful and harmful to employees, they might not feel bold enough to roll it back, right? And my experience when I was at DOL, it's, you know, the unions will have hundreds and thousands of union members filing comments and supporting the 2016 rule and saying how wonderful it is. And our side, you can rarely get employers to file comments on their own and talk about the impact and how negative it was. So if they're not willing to give that to file comments by themselves that say that, you know, I would encourage you. And Littler will be filing comments at Littler, and we'll be gathering stories like that from our clients and putting them in our comments, probably with just the industry, like you said, a university, a retailer, But those, I would like to see, and I know it's going to be really, really difficult because it didn't happen in 2004, but I would like to see lots of employers, employer management side law firms, trade associations submit thousands and hundreds of thousands of stories like that.
Public sector employers, too. They
yes, absolutely.
They were adversely impacted.
Yeah, and I can see that happening, especially the 22 states that filed the lawsuit. So we've got some states behind us. So
great. Well, thank you.
Again, to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound key on your telephone keypad. I'll make a brief announcement. Our next Teleforum conference call is scheduled for Wednesday, August 2nd at 12 noon. That call will be an RTP Teleforum with Howard Root, author of Cardiac Arrest, 5 Heart-Stopping Years as a CEO on the Fed's Hit List. A reminder to keep an eye out for emails announcing upcoming Teleforum calls and to consult the full schedule of our calls on the Federalist Society's website, fedsoc.org. Also available there are podcasts of previously recorded Teleforum calls you may have missed. I'll make a final call for questions. To ask a question, please enter star, then the pound key on your telephone keypad. Not seeing any. Tammy, would you like to make any closing remarks?
I will, and I didn't think we'd go a whole hour today, so that's good, actually. Tammy McCutcheon, you can find me at littler.com. If you are not filing comments yourself, but you would like me to consider some things to put in the comments I'll be filing, please email me. I'm happy to look at any information, any data, any stories, any points that you have that you feel should be presented to the Department of Labor. So please email, call me. I'd be happy to talk with you.
On behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank our expert for the benefit of her valuable time and expertise today. We welcome listener feedback by email at info@fedsoc.org. Thank you all for joining us. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.